children that need. Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. For those of you that aren't familiar with the program, it happens each week, 10 weeks in the fall, 10 weeks in the spring. I encourage you to get online and check out the schedule. It's there for you. My name's Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education, and I absolutely love doing this every Tuesday night. It's nice to see familiar faces and new faces, so thanks for being here. Next Tuesday evening, we have Annie Cohen-Saul here to talk about her new book, Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. It's gotten great reviews. I think it should be very interesting, and I have it from somebody I absolutely trust that she's an incredible speaker. So I think you should put it on your calendar and encourage anybody you care about to be here. We will also have a book signing before the lecture that will be in the cafe. Again, all of this is online if you need more information. I also want to announce while I have you that we're continuing the Sunday tours, Sundays at the Modern, and they've gone off beautifully. The artists, architects, scholars are talking about either the permanent collection, the architecture, or the special exhibition, in this case, Ed Ruscha. And this coming Sunday, Stephen Laptisophon will be here. He's an artist. Will be here talking about the Ed Ruscha show. So I think it should be really good. Stephen's a very smart man with a great deal of insight into the work of Ruscha and is pretty excited about doing it. So that always makes for a good combination. Speaking of excited, I've been really excited about tonight's presentation since my friend Rob Caslin brought a New York Times article on an ambitious project by the conceptual artist Mary Ellen Keller to my attention this past fall. The project was described in the Times article was Prototype 180. It's a collaboration with the artist, Rice University Building Institute, and some others who've contributed, in which a residence in a Houston suburb is literally rotated 180 degrees, not 360 degrees, like I said a few weeks ago. I had comments afterwards that that'd be a great conceptual piece. And then it's my understanding that the piece is then being finished out accordingly, according to the project, and ultimately is to become an institute for the study of considered urbanism, which I think is a beautiful concept and something I'm anxious to go and see for myself. Of the project, Yale University art historian David Joslett stated, Mary Ellen Carroll practices land art in the city in her Prototype 180, where she projects a figure as powerful as Robert Smithson's spiral jetty onto the Houston suburbs, a house that has been lifted with its slab and rotated while looking out at the surrounding neighborhood from each of its facades with a permanent digital feed. This is art that is zoned for life. Prototype 180, which Mary Ellen herself has referred to as a ground-shifting exercise for which architecture is made performative, was actually rotated on November 11th, 2010, so this past fall, and has been included in the Texas Biennial that's happening this spring, with tours beginning on April 30th. I believe that's going to be at 2 p.m. specifically on April 30th. Maybe Mary Ellen can tell us more of that, and I'm sure that she'll give us some place online to reference for that information as well. While teaching architecture at Rice University in Houston, Mary Ellen also lives and works in New York. Prototype 180 is one of many projects that Mary Ellen has subjected to the fundamental philosophical question, what do we consider a work of art? Stolen cars in desolate environments, personally challenging trips to foreign lands, doppelganger performances and tapes, rotating structures, so on and so on. Work that is carefully considered, meticulously planned, and fearlessly executed, resulting in critical acclaim, including an extensive bibliography and an impressive international exhibition record. Mary Ellen's work was included in the 2010 Greater New York exhibition at PS1, And then prototype 180 opened at Columbia University in February, just to give you some of the more recent things. And most recently, she just returned from the opening of a solo exhibition at Gallery Herbert Winter in Vienna. There's also a much anticipated monograph, which has received the American Institute of Graphic Arts Book of the Year Award, which, by the way, is en route to our bookstore now, so it will be available to you very soon. I apologize it's not here tonight. In addition to receiving numerous honors and fellowships over her 20-year career, including a Graham Fellowship, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Rockefeller Fellowship, a McDowell Colony Fellowship, and a Pollack Krasner Award, Mary Ellen has recently been recognized with an Artistic Honor Award by the American Institute of Architects in Houston, which is a great lead into tonight's presentation titled Architecture is Not Art. Please help me welcome Mary Ellen Carroll.
Good evening, everyone. And Terry, I want to give a sincere thanks to being here in Fort Worth. You know, Texas, I call casa dos. New York, I had the real estate before I had the real estate here in Texas. So it's always good to come home and to be in this building. And with such a stellar collection, is something that's really, really important to me. I think one of the things, and I'll talk about as I go into the talk a little bit more, but concrete has a very special relationship to Prototype 180, which is both a good and a bad thing. But I think, you know, to have such a significant museum and structure and the surrounding landscape, it really reflects and says a lot about the city and who actually inhabiting the title to explain it as either being a question or a provocation or a polemic. But one of the things that I do really fundamentally believe is that audiences are intelligent and the work of art is actually something that needs to be considered from the perspective of the maker, which, since audiences are intelligent, they're capable of doing that. So what I'm going to talk about tonight is primarily Prototype 180 because it's been over a 10-year process. But I'm going to give some background into some earlier works and then end with where I am today and what's actually taking place. So without further ado, do we want to do the light? Yeah, okay, perfect. You know, as many of you probably know, many artists have also academic careers. And in 1999, I was invited by the University of California at Irvine to teach a seminar that was on narrative. But no one really lives in Orange County. And there's a commute that if you miss about a 15-minute window of opportunity, it can either take you an hour and a half or it can take you almost close to 5 hours to get back to Los Angeles. So I was in a heated discussion with some of my students on Gertrude Stein and didn't feel I could tell them that I had to leave because I didn't want to get stuck in traffic, and weathered out the 5 hours. And this is actually when I conceived of Prototype 180. It had a different working title at that point, but I was thinking about the unmovable, about monumentality, about monumental works of art, not public art per se, because I think that most public art is really successful at failing, but also a form of patronage that was actually located in Texas. And I think that there's been a kind of spirit of support and entrepreneurialism that has allowed a lot of these works to exist. So, of course, you know, Smithsonian's Spiral Jetty, we have the Chinati Foundation in Marfa, Nancy Holt's Sun Tunnels. And then what I was thinking about is how their movement from, you know, that period in the 60s and 70s and a kind of poetics was usurped by architecture, namely beginning with Frank Gehry's Bilbao. But then there's many, many other examples. I would say, you know, Zaha Hadid's Firehouse in Basel, Switzerland, Rem Koolhaas's Library in Seattle. But where the kind of melding between art and architecture was created a kind of not only the facade, but a structure and something that imprinted itself onto the public's consciousness about what architecture could be, and really usurping the role of art at that kind of scale. So in 1999, this is actually the note that I wrote to myself. And for me as a practice, almost akin to drawing, is that everything begins in language, because I think that language is the thing that actually frames our existence. And as a conceptual artist, so every single work that I've ever done has always been written as a kind of statement before it's ever been realized. So 99, I wrote that I wanted to make a conceptual work of art whose process will make architecture perform in this age of the political, and to treat policy as a ready-made. So, of course, what I'm referencing is Duchamp's use of the industrial age and manufactured goods. The catalytic moment will be the revolution of a structure and its surrounding property 180 degrees. Following the rotation, everything about the building and its surroundings as a system will be reconsidered and, if necessary, redesigned and manufactured as a work of art. So now, before that, I'm just going to show a few works that have led up before 1999. And this is a little, so it's a little underexposed, but this is actually the exhibition that I have in Vienna right now at Gallery Hubert Winter. Hubert is a dealer who's a very, very unique and kind of rare breed. And he started working with American conceptual artists and minimalists, namely Fred Sandbeck, excuse me, and Lawrence Wiener, amongst others. And we've had a long relationship since the beginning of the 90s, but what we decided, and I think that this is the mistake that many artists, was to show this work, A Modest Proposal, which you see on the wall. And that was from 20 years ago. And then there's another work in the back called Act of God. And then these... So that's Act of God. This is titled Lots. And then... I wanted to go back there. But why this was important, so this piece was from 10 years ago. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things of, you know, recent events, both politically and, you know, what occurred recently in Japan, is that there are these disasters or these things that are completely out of our control. And as an accident or something that can be planned or attempted as a work of art, as an artist, would most likely fail. But with this work, it's actually, these are the site photographs for Mies van der Rohe's Farnsworth House, which is the glass house, which he actually did anticipate that the house would be flooded by the Fox River. And so what I did is I had a fellowship to work with some scientists at Xerox PARC who are encryption specialists. And what we did was we encrypted the entire narrative between Dr. Farnsworth, who commissioned Mies, and himself to actually generate these images. So what you're actually looking at is you're looking at an image, but you're not looking at a photograph, if anybody knows anything about Datacliff technology. So another example was a work that was done in Munich for the Museum for Völkerkunde. The title of the show is that we work until we can no longer work. I had inherited a car by a long story that I couldn't dispose of. And living in New York, you know, the parking can be extremely expensive. So I had a very healthy budget. And so what I wanted to do was just have the car shipped over and parked there for the duration, which was going to be about a year. Well, we realized that we couldn't get it into the building. And so I said, well, the next best thing would just be to create a car accident. So working with engineers, we figured out that if it was going 30 miles an hour at 18-degree angle, that we would actually be able to rise and have the car impact those steps without really damaging the building, which we didn't know if that was actually going to take place or not. But that being said, it did still raise the question of what if this is actually a work of art, and engaged both the mayor of Munich. Had it been, I think, in any other place, all the other museum directors, of course, and the main institutions, but I probably would have been arrested. It wouldn't have been a kind of question and consideration into what the intention actually of the work and the artist was. This was another project that was originally slated for Central Park. It was when Giuliani was the mayor of New York. So nobody really had access to Central Park at that point. Mayor Bloomberg has proven to be an advocate of the arts. And what the piece was to take something, you know, I should have prefaced, all of my work is about the double and the copy, and in effect making that which is invisible, visible. So this was to take a stolen car from the 80s, place it into the middle of Central Park, based on a series of drawings to actually find that exact center. Long story short, in terms of financing and the mayor's participation, that program got cut, and then there was a private commission by a collector who has a sculpture park in upstate New York. So with that, we basically found the center point of his property, a crane that would be able to take, suspend and lift the car over the tops of the trees and then drop it down into the center, so that, in effect, it was something that was always there. So they were incredibly resistant when I first proposed this to them. But then they ended up going ahead and saying, giving me the approval to do it. Initially, they wanted there to be a very large audience in attendance, of which I told them, no, there's only going to be 5 people, which will be my crew and then the crew that are the riggers. And the reason for this is because there was going to be the artifact there. So the people that it really resonated in terms of the narrative of the process as performance, it didn't need to have 10,000 people as they have on their open day, when everybody from, you know, this particular region of upstate New York comes in. So it existed on 3 levels: the performance, the photographs that were taken as a, there's 3 images, and then there's actually a film. And it really became a piece that was really beloved by the owner of the property and the people that worked for him. And they asked me about 3 years ago to they commissioned me to do another work. And I always think it's good to know when you've either made a mistake or you've gone too far and when it's time to stop doing what you're doing. So I told them that no, I really actually wasn't interested, because what would I do in relation to what I had already done? And they said, but no, please. And I said, okay, well, you know, if this is something that you love so much, I think that what we'll do is we'll do the whole thing in reverse. So the car will actually be exhumed from the position that it's in, and then we'll bury it in the location that it was originally taken from. And they said, okay, fine, but what about the audience? And I said, well, then you can have 10,000 people, because imagine that you have 10,000 people walking around the property trying to figure out where the actual location of where it's buried at, because there's not going to be any kind of marker that's there. So Federal was another project where I had been photographing in the vein of the Becker School of German photography, all the federal buildings in the United States. And when September 11th happened, of course, that became almost impossible. And I had a Guggenheim to complete this work. So rather than try to move around the processes and to do something as a kind of guerrilla act, which would never be possible, something that I work with actually quite a bit is the process that you engage in and the bureaucracy itself. So it took about a year and a half to get the permission from the FBI, the CIA, and there were a couple of local police groups. And finally, one day I received a phone call that it would be fine to actually make the movie. So what I was proposing was to actually make a 24-hour film where we had a film crew, which this is the front of the building, and then that's the back of the building, which would be shooting simultaneously. We'd start at 9 o'clock in the morning. We'd finish at 9 o'clock the next day. And then this was actually a series of photographs that were done as a kind of portrait of the front that continued what I had already started on all the other structures throughout the United States. So, and then just one other. I have a very extensive group of lawyers who I work with both on intellectual property, in terms of copyright issues, but then also in collaboration on works of art. And this was a project that I was invited to also in Munich. It was organized by a curator and an architect who created something called a Gepo. And a Gepo was a building that had no use. So in effect, it was closer to a work of art than a work of architecture. But what they did was they sent a kind of plan that you could cut up and put together and color and paste, of which I had no interest in doing. But given that they were in Germany, what I knew was that somehow the rights to this thing called the Gepo would be something that I could actually acquire in the rest of the world. So I called my lawyer and I said, okay, is this actually possible? You know, as a work of art, what we'll do is we'll isolate that spot in which they've created, which is nothing. It was really an idea. And then the piece that was actually sent was the fax from the law office. And their response was, the title of the work is Why Are Americans So Mean? But I think it was actually the work that they truly wanted to do. And then just some other larger scale works. This was a commission for an organization called the Precipice Alliance. It was their inaugural piece, which was on climate change. And, you know, it's difficult, I think, to make works of art on specific issues. And so the challenge was to use the material that people really understand or think they understand the issue in, and that also it would be something that once, you know, the issue went out of people's consciousness, that the work of art had to remain. And so this was along the Pulaski Skyway as you went into Manhattan, and it says, "It is green thinks nature even in the dark." And I had a great group of collaborators, including this man named Chester Jenkins, who actually I asked him to design an energy-efficient typeface, which he did. And that work is titled Indestructible Language. So as of this morning, I have actually directly engaged with 3,018 individuals on Prototype 180. And I'm not talking about casual conversations to just introduce the work, but where people have actually directly been involved in some way. And that will continue. So one of the things in starting to work, I mean, there's one thing to be, you know, stuck in traffic and driving down the highway and imagine doing this thing. And then when you actually start to do it, there's a lot of work involved. And, you know, the one thing that I actually say to my architecture students is that architecture is inherently a political act. It begins far before the moment of which you're actually designing, but it also, there's so much involved in the creation of municipalities, how land use is determined. And the reason why I'm actually in Texas is because, as I stated at the beginning, in saying that we are living in this political epoch, I wanted there to be a policy condition that would imply a kind of freedom. And as you may know, that Houston has no zoning. There's no formal land use policy. And it's really something that reflects the culture of the city. It's not something that, you know, one makes a kind of value judgment of it being or good or bad. It just is. So Houston chose me. Texas chose me for the site of Prototype 180. And what was implied is that there's a kind of freedom that having, you know, 10,000 acres in New Mexico or in West Texas was possible or suggested by determining its location to actually be there. So one of the first people that I actually met with was this man, Keith Cherry. This was in 2000, because I wanted to know if it was going to be possible to move a concrete slab on grade, and what were the kind of conditions of the site. So it began here in 2000. The other thing is where would it be in Houston? I didn't want to do something that would be considered to be a kind of urban redevelopment project. I think, you know, there's plenty of artists that treat and consider their work as a kind of social endeavor, but I don't really feel that that's our responsibility, or at least for myself. But in this, I started to do some extensive mapping work on where it could actually take place, and I really wanted a location that would be somewhat invisible. So, you know, I started in this first quadrant, came over to this area, moved out, and then really ended up focusing in this southwest section. And it was because part of it was the kind of growth pattern that was taking place. So Houston's going to grow by 1 million people that they anticipate in the next 5 to 10 years and will become the third largest city in the United States. So in that direction, and what you ended up having, you know, what you saw was that, is that going to go on here? Yeah. Every time, like these areas, people would buy the homes, tear them down, build to every square inch of the property. And once that happened and the property became a certain value, they would incorporate and become their own cities. So, I mean, this is all Houston, but you have, this is a city which is West U, you have Bel Air, and then the next area was Sharpstown. Sharpstown is an area that I've been doing research and writing about for almost 20 years now, and it's an aging first-ring suburb, so which means that it's still within the city, but that there are certain conditions, and there's a Sharpstown in every major metropolitan area in the United States. So the other part of this is, how do you pay for something like this, right? Who's going to become your institutional partners? So from 2000 to 2002, I met with roughly about 25 curators and museum directors. It pretty much was the same conversation. First, I was told that it was incredibly ambitious. It would take me 20 years to do, and it would be about $3 million. Well, it's taken 10 years, not even close to that in terms of the budget. But the other thing is, if everything I'm thinking about and doing is actually being reconsidered, I also needed to reconsider how this would actually be done. And so what I decided, well, I'll go into that in a little bit, but I also went and went around with some of the partners of Keith Cherry's to find out what kind of structure would actually work. Let me just play this.
I'm getting these. It's got carports on the side. Now, that's a small little house. If you take the carport off of it and turn it around and expand that house, would work. See, that's not expensive to take off because you're not much to take off. You tear all those carports off, you can turn that house around.
Hmm.
See, this one here would work. And if you could find something like that. If you know, if the house is not longer than what the lot is wide, that's going to be the key. See, a lot of these houses were built to cover the maximum amount of the property.
So, and needless to say, I mean, there's thousands and thousands of hours of video documentation and detail, and we have very extensive records on every conversation. An engagement
here in that is year 2000, all of the Sharpstown area just started skyrocketing on its prices. And, you know, 5 years ago, I kept telling people it would happen, and they just kept saying, oh, no, you know,
it won't.
Low economy, you know, just whatever their scenario was. And I'm going, you guys, you're not paying attention to what's happening. And they said, but the prices aren't going up. And I'm going, yes, but the inventory is going down. And every year the inventory would get smaller and smaller. And I'd keep saying, you guys, we're going to hit a time when the prices are going to start really ratcheting up. Because all we had to do was work through that excess inventory that we created back in the 80s when the oil prices went down and people lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So folks that were here stable, they weren't selling because, you know, they didn't need to. They might have taken early retirement,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't, like, lose a job and have to go to Boston to have a job. You know, they just kind of stayed. Well, so they were just waiting for the prices to be acceptable, you know. So
that was Betty Towns, and Betty has a real estate company, and we worked extensively for almost 5 years to try and find a property. And I would come down, I mean, in addition to teaching, but also I would say another 5 or 6 times a year, and we would spend, and we looked at hundreds of homes to find the right condition. And in 2002, what I started to look at was, one of the conditions was to make sure that we had one part of the property be that would abut public lands. And so in looking at aerial photographs, this actually became the kind of area that I wanted to focus on. And this, you can see this sort of darker green is Balin Park, which is a county park that is much beloved. It's about 70 acres, and it's full of sports fields. So on May 27th of 2003, Betty Towns and I were driving to look at another property. I asked her to go down this block that where all the houses abutted this county park. And this is actually the house that I saw, and I said, stop the car immediately. And she said, well, that's not for sale. It's been uninhabited for 13 years at that point. And I said, no, that's the site. And she said, why? And I said, because there's a whole host of reasons. I mean, one, it's necessary that something is done to it, but that also its location and having the county park on the back, there's 5 other properties that are contiguous to it. And that it was in relatively stable condition. And this is actually what the back looked like. So even before the property was acquired, one of the things that was done was I was meeting extensively with the Civic Association in the city But then also, I was having the property maintained. So, and that's also because what can happen is there are tickets, neighborhood protection, which is a part of the police force, can actually come around and give you a ticket for, you know, letting your grass grow too high, which there's a great story of Michael Pollan's father, who he refused to have their lawn cut. And the neighbors were furious about it, and so there was only one family who actually was still in contact with them, who came over, and they thought they were going to be able to broker a deal, of which the next day he just went out and mowed his initials into the front lawn. So I didn't think that would be a particularly effective method. So this is an overview, so you can see the sketch of what would actually happen. So here, this is the actual location. This is the street. These are the neighboring properties. And then this is Balin Park. There's a senior citizens softball league that resides on this field. There's one of the best pickup games, not pickup in that sense, but pickup games of soccer, which is located here. And so what was going to happen is that the rotation would happen from the middle of the property, and it's actually quite a large lot. It's roughly... So this was the simulation of what would actually take place. And when this was actually done, it's actually very close to what, except for this little Wizard of Oz moment, but... Oops, sorry about that. I want to back up for... Wait, let me just... come on. Yeah, it's not going to let me do it. But one of the things that I wanted to point out was that I also... there's a very specific way in which we're using technology on the site, too. So in roughly 2001, I knew that it would be possible for the building to basically be the protagonist or the actor in the entire process, and that we would see what was taking place from its perspective. So presently, and if you go to prototype 180, which I'll pull up at the end, but there are now 6 high-definition cameras that are not used as a form of surveillance, but they're actually used to show your reaction to what's actually taking place at the building site. And the reason why that was actually done was because, you know, we are living in this moment of simultaneity where I'm sure everybody in the audience has a cell phone with a camera or some kind of PDA that they can take a picture of, you know, while they're talking, while they're seeing, while they're experiencing. And more, I mean, this was 10 years ago, I knew that this was going to be the way in which people actually framed their experience of things. So to cut that distribution and dissemination method that, say, somebody like Christo had, where they merchandise the hell, you know, out of every single thing that's being produced, but to be very intentional and to say, no, this is what I'm actually going to be providing on an ongoing basis, and that these are the materials that are going to be generated. So, so with that, just to show, prototype 180, it's in Sharpstown. It's connected to Rice University, Columbia University, something called Internet 2 through the National Science Foundation, V2 in Rotterdam, the ZKM in Karlsruhe, and then beyond into the public sphere. Okay, so as I mentioned, that the property wasn't for sale. So going to the Harris County tax records, I found the owner sent a certified letter, which makes me think, don't ever answer a certified letter from anybody. About 6 weeks after that, I received a phone call from this gentleman, Dr. Ramesh Kapoor, who said, we are the owners of the property, which it ended up only being him. But we worked on this deal for many, many, many years. And I was telling Terry, there's so many stories and anecdotes which are not really that interesting, but I think to just keep in mind the level of persistence and how this part of the process, and knowing that this was the right property, but then there were some other properties that came into play as well. So another part, you know, one of the perks of being an artist and as a Rockefeller fellow was to spend time at Bellagio at their villa. And this is where I actually did a lot of writing and work of considering policy as a material or ready-made. And that was done in mainly in 2004. So the other thing before the acquisition of the property went through, I wanted to make sure that because of the deed restrictions, which are one of the forms of regulation, that I was going to have the approval from the Civic Association. So in 2006, I was actually given the approval by the Architecture Committee for the Sharpstown Civic Association to rotate the address, which is 6513 Sharpview. The other thing that I did, as I mentioned, in forming the corporation and having both collectors of my work and then some key people who I went to and asked that they could be subscribers to the project and the corporation for a minimum of $25,000. And that was how we raised the initial monies to acquire the property, take care of the liens, all kinds of legal issues. And when, you know, I've been questioned about that, and that was only for phase one, but if you, you know, do the math for something like that, over 10 years' time, I mean, that's relatively minor in comparison to a lot of things that are actually being done. But I think that the economics, there's an economist, David Gallinson, at the University of Chicago, who's actually been following Prototype 180 and the actual process economically to figure out both the kind of valuation and what it will actually become in the future. So, and as I was talking about the kind of restraints, one of the deed restrictions, so when the front would become the back and vice versa, was that there would be cedar siding. And the cedar siding, rather than get a variance to go around what the existing rules or conditions were, it's always been the approach to try to use that to somehow innovate or create some kind of new material. I had the good fortune to work with the Kohler Company and developed a porcelain cladding material for the exterior that would be used. So it actually looks like cedar siding, but it's porcelain, of which we have a patent for. So the negotiations were still ongoing with Dr. Ramesh Kapoor, so then I would continue to go and look at properties with Betty Towns. Excuse me, and also there were some real estate auctions. And finally, on June 29th, 2007, we actually closed, and OFPC, the LLC, actually acquired the title. And this is just the closing document. So the documents themselves are a part of the archive and considered to actually be material. So this was the house, the date of that closing. These are some of the interior shots. So obviously you can see that it needs some work to be done. But I was actually talking to Terry, there's so many actually really exquisite details in this building, not the one I'm pointing at, but the Ando building. But there is, I mean, this is actually a really exquisite little house that was architected by a University of Houston professor. And this Meissian wall, so referencing Mies van der Rohe, is a double brick wall that extends out to create a patio, which was, you know, sliding glass doors. They weren't these French doors. This was the kitchen. This was the hallway. It had three bedrooms, Jack and Jill bathroom. At one point, some kids broke into it, of course, and used it as their some kind of house. And then cedar siding bathroom, circa 1970. And then just some more exterior. So one of the things, too, is that, you know, everything had been cut off, so everything has to be brought back, of which we had to bring in electricity. So there's this saw pole. And what's going to happen is that the entire interior is going to be gutted. I mean, in effect, the house will be completely rebuilt, except it will still maintain its profile as it appears now. There is going to be... it will be all handicap accessible. There's going to be a bathroom, a kind of floating kitchen, which I'm working. Maybe we can make a group decision about this, but it's between GE and Mealy. And then this table or stage, of which there will be bleacher seating so that you can actually view into Balin Park, which is going to be behind. The other thing I was able to do at Kohler was to work on designing all the bathroom fixtures. So I did the sink, lavatory, toilets, a urinal, a bidet. And we actually went into production on these on a relatively small scale. So the title of this is Pigro, which means lazy in Italian. And there I am in the factory. So the form, rather than designing a form, it was to use the actual manufacturing process. So they used this form to actually stabilize the wear. And this recessed area is actually the best-selling sink ever in the history of Kohler. So I thought that was a good model to reference. And then... part of it, too, was that I thought, you know, it's a backbreaking, really labor-intensive process to make those molds. And I thought, well, we could have just poured the slip over this form and that it would burn out, but that wasn't possible. So it was my actually trying to be lazy as well, which never really works. These are some of the models of the toilets up here, and then this, you can see, is the porcelain cladding material. That we will continue with. And then the drains, of course, were something else that was done there. And these are the finished product. So, and in the end, I mean, these have gone, they will go actually into Prototype 180, but they're also in both private collections. And a couple of museums have also acquired them for their design and architecture programs. So, as well, working with Rice University, the Rice University Building Institute, then actually having water brought to the site. So, since it had been uninhabited, they didn't know where the mains were, which we quickly found out. We have had beehives that have brought back in because there are fruit trees, and those will reappear. They're also a really good security device for kids that are trying to break into the property. And this was the table that was I showed that's going to appear, and there was an exhibition called No Zoning at the Contemporary Arts Museum in Houston. And what I had been working on was the prototype. So they wanted to actually do something with Prototype 180, but I said there's nothing to do because nothing has happened yet. But what we can do is actually program something and create the prototype of the table. So it just shows some of the references from, you know, the Paris Peace Talks, which... I mean, if you look at that expanse, how anybody could even hear one another. And then, you know, of course, the shakers. But what I wanted it to be was both a table and a stage, so if one felt so inspired, they could actually grandstand, but that it could be something that would be utilized for presentations. And that we would incorporate the floor because there was actually very good flooring material that was specified. So this was the configuration. And then this was the actual prototype. And I organized, so part of it was to program it as it would actually be used once we do the work at the site in Sharpstown. So part of that was to organize a mayoral forum when the election was taking place on land use and zoning. And the first question that I asked the candidates was yes or no, because it's hard to get a yes or a no out of politicians, and whether or not they would approve zoning or land use, some kind of land use policy. And hands down, everybody said no. So I just said we had to come up with a new word. So one of the things that's going to happen, and I have to say, I mean, there's incredible resources in this state, and I've worked extensively with engineers at NASA, my model maker, which I'll show you in a little moment, was the model maker for all of the space shuttles. But what this has evolved into is that we're going to have this kind of drop stair on a hydraulic system that will go down through the table. And I'm doing that with Harris County, with the woodworking studio at the jail. So here you have the site plan for the survey, which was done in 2009. This is another part that's going to be created for a fencing system, of which we just actually received our patent for, what's called the hydro wall, and it's a flexible substrate that you can actually use for agricultural as well as a kind of fencing or vertical garden wall. The creation of the identity, of course, which I mentioned Chester Jenkins before, and for the Innovation Territory. The Innovation Territory is actually focusing on these aging first-ring suburbs and policies. So I've worked with the Department of Energy and the City of Houston. So if you just have the project of Prototype 180 as the model or laboratory, the other thing is that it's to impact the entire area simultaneously, so it's really important that these other programs and policy and ideas are actually taking place and to use innovative technologies as a way to do that. That's just canvassing. So we also had a location. We're going to introduce solar into the neighborhood. And so these were these solar containers that we used as our offices that actually had solar panels that, you know, have a kind of bridge system where we ran everything for months with that. And then there's also going to be a relay system of a kind of wireless cloud that we're going to put in the neighborhood, where I've been working with a colleague of mine at Rice, this man named Ed Knightley, who does work on remote sensing. There's a workforce development project. And then one of the things I've also been working on is the Sharpstown Mall, which is about 20% occupied. It has it's problematic in the city, and it suffers from a kind of negative perception problem. But I organized a charrette, of which I invited 12 of the leading architecture firms in the city of Houston to consider what this site could actually be and what does it need to be for redevelopment. And we're now at a phase, actually, with the mayor and another group of actually seriously engaging in determining what the site is actually going to be for the future. Then it also extends to the neighbor, the park behind, with lighting. So I think that one of the things, you know, I think to think about is it goes back to what Terry started with, what is a work of art? But, you know, ways in which we're aware and the risks that one is willing to take relative to what their work actually is. So then one of the things, too, is, again, seeing Dr. Kapoor post-closing for a property tax hearing to have the value reassessed. So on September 10th, I just want to watch the time, of 2010, we started the actual work for the catalytic moment for Prototype 180. And as Keith Cherry described it, that, you know, Mary Ellen, he said it's materials and labor. Well, it's a whole lot more than just materials and labor. But basically what they do is they use these railroad ties to create a kind of cribbing system where there are these trenches that are dug out around the foundation. And then these hydraulic jacks go under, and they very, very gradually start to lift up the building. So one of the things, I mean, the home was built in 1960. There was a lot of lore, which I'll show you the image of in a second, about the area. But when they started to lift up the entire building with that concrete slab, it really did become a sculpture at that moment. I mean, it was completely severed from its site, and it was performing, as they thought, beautifully. So those are the jacks. That's the machine that is actually used to control the jacks. This is the super on the job, Russell. And you can see that this is how you could actually see all the way through to the other side. They use basically these water levels to make sure that everything is even as it's going up. And on this was October 1st at 2010 at 1 p.m. And this was Luis, who was actually has been involved in the very beginning. So there were roughly 15 to 20 people a day for 2 months that were working on this. And what they decided at this point, we were probably close to 5 feet up in the air, and that they were going to go 4 more inches for the wheels to fit under comfortably. And one of the things, keep in mind, like, we were all under this. I mean, everybody was working under this, crawling under it. And then on October 1st, at 2010 at 2:30, and I know exactly what time it was because I had an interview with a reporter from the New York Times, and she called me and said, "So what are you doing right now?" And I said, "Oh, well, it's really incredible. You know, the building is really behaving like a, you know, like a bad child. The building is really behaving. The foundation is, you know, intact." And suddenly I heard this crack, and the building moved. Well, the whole back end, and this is why I'm talking about good concrete work, had fallen out. And so the lore in Sharpstown and many other parts of where there was a concrete slab, which was the foundation, was that when Frank Sharp, and he was a crook, but besides doing many other things, you know, they would plot out, say, 20 homes. They'd do the form work, right? They put the wood in for the foundation. They put the metal in. And then the inspectors would come out and say, okay, yes, that's the right amount of steel or not. And then in the cover of night, if it wasn't a load-bearing area, somebody would go and they would yank out all the steel. So basically, you just had a piece of concrete with nothing in it. And, I mean, it really, it's incredible that we had even, you know, this. And then this, of course, is why this happened. So as I was talking about the process, I mean, there's two things. Cherry also has a demolition company, which I really, it wasn't the right moment to be in contact with them. But they also, we could have salvaged the front part of the slab, which I don't think any good relationship is by marrying the good and the bad. So the decision was to just move forward and to take out what was there. So that was what we started on October 1st. The other thing that I mentioned about the House being able to show us our reaction to its process was in working with William Dygard, who came up with the system. And remember, one of the things I had started to talk to satellite companies, and they said, yeah, sure, we'll be able to transmit the image. And it was good, you know, that things took 10 years, but it's hard to see this, but right now he's pulling up his iPhone and he's seeing the same thing that the actual building is seeing. So, which was very exciting. And then on November 11th, we actually rotated the property 180 degrees. So at this moment, the building is completely removed from the site. And you can see the kind of paths of which, you know, we could have brought it back through the park, you know, to the left or the right, straight back. We could have brought it this direction, that direction. And there are very detailed drawings that reflect all of that, but we were going to this side, and, you know, there's a host of reasons why. I mean, because of the utilities that were there that wouldn't have to be removed. This is when we're actually moving it down the street. That's when it was being pulled off. And then this is the actual aerial view of when we reconnected it back to a new foundation, which has quite a bit of steel in it, on January 11th, 2011. So you can see, I mean, and if you go to, which I'll pull up, to the site for the stream, but this is basically the sort of condition, and as I have said before, is that this is actually when the architecture begins, but it's relatively easy in comparison to everything else that, you know, has taken place just to get here. So currently, there's the exhibition at the Graduate School of Architecture and Planning. There's a special building at Columbia University. And this is the exhibition that's there. So there's a timeline. There's the video of the rotation. There's the live feed. And then a kind of historical documentation of all the photographs of the process. So that just shows you the live feed of the cameras. This is the exquisite model that I was talking about that I used to talk to many people about the project, but it shows, it's got this pivoting device where it shows before and then after. And then as I also mentioned that in terms of you have, the work itself is the work of art, but then there is one diptych that I photographed with a large format 4x5 camera, which was the last moment. This is the last moment before anything was done in terms of the rotation or the alteration of the structure. So it's just, it's the front and the back. Okay, and to go back, I think that also, as an artist, you understand, at a certain point, you really see your process, and conceptually, knowing what it is, what I do, and having that understanding, but also not having a signature style in terms of all the work looking the same, either formally. But this was a drawing that I did that's in the exhibition in Vienna, which is from 1992, and the drawings were all based on actions that would actually make architecture perform. And, of course, using the kind of plane as the site that would then rotate that 180 degrees. So you know, in effect, it was there imprinted on my conscience before even knowing it. You know, I leave you with, I don't, you have to answer that for yourself of whether or not architecture is art. I think this building certainly challenges us to possibly think about it being that, but you know, as I mentioned, that as the viewers, you make those informed decisions because you're educated and you know how to ask the questions of what the intention of the actual artist is. So I want to just thank you, and if anybody has any questions, it's really been a pleasure to be here this evening. Yes?
The table.
Yes.
Stairs. Could you talk about your decision to have, you said it was inmates at the Harris County Jail?
Yes.
Work on that? Could you elaborate on that a little bit more, why you chose?
Because, part of it, I've done work in the jails and the prisons for some time. And the project and the person that runs that woodworking studio, I've seen some of the incredible things that have come out of it and the engagement that has happened with people. And it's also to talk about the county is many things in the same way that the city is many things. And as the public, right, as taxpayers and you know, facilitators, how do you engage in as many of those services or areas as possible? So that was, yeah.
Well, were the NASA scientists working with the inmates at all? Didn't they work on the hydraulics, you said?
They did the engineering for it, yeah. So, I mean, they weren't in the big house, but they were in the big house. So, yes. Yes.
You know, some time ago in the last hour, a question came to my mind, and I just wonder if it's appropriate or maybe a little more common. Would it be not off the mark to say that you're kind of like the Borat of the grant world?
The Borat of the, I didn't get the...
Of the foundation grant world?
Borat of the foundation. I don't know what you mean by that.
You know what Borat was?
Yeah.
Who he was?
I do. I know Sacha Baron Cohen, but
what's the aside from I don't know, or maybe you have an idea of your labor valuation. But what would you put on a bottom line for the price of the project?
When it's done. I can't say it. I mean, I've said as the figure, and I mean, this is public information, but up to this point, it's been about $350,000 over 10 years. So, I mean, 35 grand a year, I think that's incredibly reasonable. And
it depends on what you get at the end of 10 years.
Well.
Or how much it would have cost to knock the building down and build something else.
Yes.
Are you an engineer or an architect?
Am I?
Yes.
I'm neither. I'm just a skeptic. Yeah.
Maybe cynic is a better. I appreciate. You know, I engage in repartee, so I like people that actually sort of push back intelligently and provocatively. And I think that there are many questions that are raised. I mean, I think that one of the things I was anticipating that you were going to say was why. I think if anything, how a work of art or literature or music is successful because it makes us consider our own existence in the world. So the kind of, you know, basic questions of the kind of value, I mean, we could discuss many of the works in this collection and ask what the purchase price was and the value and what is it actually as a work of art. So I think that area, which I'm is of interest to me is that gray area of which, you know, as I said, it was necessary for something to be done to that structure, that it also, in conceiving of it, was a way to make architecture perform as a dynamic process. I mean, the other thing is, too, once a building is built, in most people's minds, including architects, is that that's it. It's a static, it becomes a static thing, even though it has a system that keeps it sort of engaged and tethered to the municipality and the rest of the world. And once we get to work on the actual renovation and revitalization, you know, that ends up being a collaboration in terms of the development of the technologies and what actually needs to be there. So, excuse me, but it's what's necessary. Yes. I don't know if that answers your question.
You said that you don't see architecture as, or you said it's inherently political.
Yes.
But then you said you wanted to stay away from urban renewal because it was social. And my immediate mind to me, I mean, urban renewal is always political, but I guess the question I want to ask is, where do you draw the line from political to social? Because it seemed like you had some, maybe you have an inherent understanding of it, but for me they seem so blurred. Where's the line between political and social?
There is a line. I think. I mean, we can talk about a lot of artists who identify their practices as either being social, and I think there's significant number, particularly, you know, sort of revisiting performance. But what I'm talking about in the specific is that if you intentionally frame your work as being social or political. Okay, so it's that, you know, I'm saying I'm, you know, a social activist as an artist, which I don't think is I don't think it's necessary, and I think that that's a way of making things really easily digestible and understandable, which I can understand, but it's a choice not to do that. So, yes.
You talked some about issues relating to distribution or dissemination,
mm-hmm.
and I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about where you were trying to go with it, what were some alternatives
okay.
you might have considered and rejected, you know, that
sure,
kind of thing.
Sure. Part of that, I mean, if you look at, as I said, the unmovable, okay, say the land art pieces that I referenced, architecture, nature. If you go to Yosemite or something, you know, you can't. It's not something you can bring home with you, right? I mean, you can. You have the experience and the kind of imprinting, but then you either have the postcard or the photograph or the memento of that thing. And I think that our networks now, the kind of systems by which we communicate and navigate and also interact both with the cultural institutions and the educational institutions are really changing incredibly rapidly. So with that, what I wanted to say was, okay, besides making that one last moment photograph as the 4x5, as a photo, as a work of art, the rest of it is to consider what age are we living in? If we're living in this age of simultaneity where everything is about binary code, right? I mean, and it's just going to be faster and better and quicker and more readily available to anticipate and really use that as the distribution system in how that information would be made available and to who. And you know, it also makes it possible that you can do things on a very local level, but then, you know, you can have somebody in, where's an apolitical example now? Bali or something that can also be looking at it simultaneously. And I think when and as I mentioned, the feed is still viewable, which I can see. Well, you can actually pull it up, but while we were doing the rotation, you know, I was hearing from people in Brazil and India, and so there's also a kind of awareness of the audience a collectivity that I think has changed quite a bit. And I think the internet too, which was started by the National Science Foundation so that supercomputers at universities could talk to one another. There's a woman named Ann Doyle who's involved in their cultural programming. And when we started working on this, I mean, their main focus has been, of course, in music, and classical music in particular. But now they really understand what can be done in terms of the visual arts. So...
compared it to another approach that involved marketing the hell out of it, and I don't know if that's what you are trying to do or not do. For example, you could have just bought a server and set up a website without any fanfare. Obviously, that probably wouldn't match up with your purposes, but I'm kind of like, how did you select the institutions that you would work with for this distribution network and that sort of thing?
Well, it is on a server, so anybody can actually utilize it. But I think that one of the things, it's to find, you know, you always find the partner that you need to find. I mean, I think that unless you have some really serious judgment issues, but, you know, that's somebody else's problem to figure out. But I think that with that, you know, there are very few places where there are people that want to engage in these issues between art and architecture. And not to say this one's, you know, good or that one's bad, but where it ends up being generative and a kind of expansive proposition to sort of think of. And so I think, you know, that's why it's been good. I mean, I also, besides Rice, I also work with the University of Houston as well. And, you know, the other thing too was that it was important not to have only one cultural institution be involved, because the project was there, so I could be friends to all, you know, in a certain sense. Yes?
How long will this continue?
No, God, no.
Is it just going to sort of knowing the site?
No. You know, I'm sure that I will always have some kind of involvement, but I think, you know, what we anticipate is now we're in phase two, which is really, you know, the engineering and construction begins, and that looks like it's probably about 2 to 3 years. But, you know, remember, it's like it has been really hands-on. I don't think it's not... Having actually project managed some very large architectural projects, this is something that could not have been done remotely. And, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm deluding myself, but it was really necessary to sort of be there. It wasn't something that could be phoned in, because there were so many decisions that were being made, and that, as I was saying, that the process is really a part of the work. And so that had to be something that I completely understood, you know, on an ongoing, on a daily basis. So, pardon? Yes.
Will this be a public space when it's completed? You have a table? And...
Yes, it will be. One of the things is that there are deed restrictions. So in terms of it being, you know, a public center or something, so it has to maintain itself as a single-family home. But what one does in their single-family homes behind closed doors is their prerogative. So I think you know, and I'm not just being, you know, cheeky about that, but I think the idea is that the building will be able to run itself and study itself through the systems that we're going to put into place. And so then it will actually be used to, you know, look as an institute as at the crossroads between culture and architecture, but also urban planning and aging first-ring suburbs. And there's many, you know, as I mentioned, like from the Brookings Institute that looks at urbanism and how, you know, how we live and how we work. I mean, they're focusing on it, the Rockefeller Foundation. And, you know, it's going to be, we're going to have to see, but I think within that time frame, and then, you know, there's always a question of stewardship, of who's, like, who's going to be the next generation that's going to, you know, be supporting the modern here, and how do you cultivate that kind of interest and engagement and maintain it? Yes?
I think what you're doing is absolutely fantastic. I actually grew up less than 10 blocks from the site.
Oh, you did?
I'm Hillcroft, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, I look forward to going back to Houston and checking out what's going on there.
Sharpstown proud.
Okay. Yeah, go Sharpstown.
Hi. Yes.
So is there going to actually be someone living there? Is there a place with a beekeeper? Will it be student housing? What's going to be the usage, I mean, long term?
Well, as I mentioned, that as an institute, in terms of that, it will be used for education, for study, for consideration. There will be one sort of possibility where there could be an in-house scholar or somebody that would stay there in residence. And that's going to reveal itself. I mean, I have the plans, but I think that also it's also one of the things of architecture in terms of the program of what a, you know, what a space is actually used for. It's like, well, what is that going to be used for? And to take the time and to sort of let it evolve, but into what we've directed it, you know, to actually be.
It'll be explained on your website, I take it, as it evolves.
It'll explain. And the other thing is that the website's going to become so data, information, you know, the other part is to make it as transparent as possible, and to really engage with the surroundings and the city, that it will extend to a national but also a kind of, you know, global model. And to take things that are put into practice that maybe you can transfer that information or technology or not. I mean, but I think that, you know, you have to be able to take the risk and see and fail and try something else.
We'll see if it impacts the local real estate market.
Well, there's speculation, but that's, I'm not buying additional property. but please, there's actually a really, I can show you which house you should buy. Yes.
What kind of action do you get from the neighbors?
That's a question I get. Besides the why, that's another question that I get quite frequently, and it's a very important one. It runs the gamut from one neighbor who I think eats glass for breakfast in the morning, so you can imagine what her response is, to people that, this is actually quite moving. There's a couple who's been in the area that lives down the street since Frank Sharp developed Sharpstown in the 50s. And they're lovers of animals, and so they walk their dogs in the evening. And one night they stopped and they said, you know, at first we had no idea what you were doing and what was going on, but we can totally see it. And you know, we get it, like we understand it in terms of what it's doing as a work art. We get what it's doing in terms of the neighborhood. And
we really appreciate it. And so you have, I mean, I think it's like in anything. I mean, and that's what I was saying, of that architecture, even if it's in the private, and once that rotation took place, the piece really entered the public realm. It entered into a kind of public consciousness that you have, I feel, you know, I have a responsibility to engage and to, you know, engage in a dialogue with and to be open about. But yeah, I mean, there were many detractors, many people that said it wasn't going to happen, you're going to fail. Terry and I were actually talking about one of the things when that slab collapsed, and also I kept thinking of Richard Serra, when he had a problem when he was there was a rigger that was killed when he had a piece that was being installed, and how far would you actually go? Not that far, fortunately, that nothing happened, but. People are watching all the time. And I think to also make it as transparent as can be. I mean, there's nothing, there's nothing high. There's no money laundering. And to, maintain a kind of open dialogue, as I said. So, Emmy, should we close it?
Yeah.
So... So anyway, I really appreciate everybody being here tonight. I know it's a gorgeous night, but to come in. And you can follow the updates, of course, at Prototype 180. As Terry mentioned, on April 30th, there's going to be a tour that's part of the Texas Biennial, which I think we're doing. Actually, we're doing it at 11:30 in the morning. It's going to be earlier. They changed that, and come to Houston. I mean, you can see it, so it's there. And as well, there's actually supposed to be a very positive review in the New York Times on Friday. So I don't know if you read that newspaper, but some of us do. But anyway, so thank you again, and really. Thank you.